Do we have a quorum?
No.
Do we need one yet?
No.
We can start?
All right. We'll call the Agriculture Committee to order. I should have figured out what we're going to do. We're going to get Bickerman up first with Senate File 2724. Bickerman, biodiesel. Legs, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll be working on Senate File 2724. It's the biodiesel fuel regulations modification, B20 panel formation, petroleum inspection, fee revenue dedication, cold weather, biodiesel blending fuel terminal grants appropriations. Members and audience, I apologize if we don't have a full crew here, but there's four or five meetings going on because the session went longer than it was supposed to. So what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, I'm gonna move the bill, but we can't act on it because we don't have enough members
right
here to.
And you
to
have
do
a
that.
Author's
well, I,
amendment.
I have a delete all that I want to work off of.
We can't adopt it, but we can certainly discuss it. Yep.
Yep. We'll talk off the A3, and when a quorum comes
here,
in,
we'll act on it. Sounds good. So we have the A3 amendment before us.
Mr. Chair, what we're trying to do is work on a biodiesel fuel, renewable, biodegradable, combustible liquid fuel. And, you know, if you look on delayed all, by the year 2005, it's 2%. 2009 is 5%. 2012, we go to 10%. In 2015, we go to 20%. And so we're moving along, I think, very well. It's just one of those things that, and I suppose 100% of people aren't exactly 100% for it. But I think it's something that we need to do, help rural Minnesota and actually help the environment in the whole state. So, Mr. Chair, I know we can't act on it, but I have a couple people that I would like to come up and explain it, if you would, because we do
want
to be out of here by 5:30 because there's another meeting going, and I have another meeting, and I think some of the rest of us do. So
I think most
of us probably
do. If I
could have Commissioner Hugesson, if he would step forward, and Jerry Schoenfeld, maybe, and kind of help me walk through this.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee. State your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Gene Hugesson, Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
And you can proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Bickerman, just a quick overview of the biodiesel situation in Minnesota. Many of you will remember that this legislation first was broached back in 2002, and at that particular time there was talk about actually introducing legislation that would implement a 5% requirement for biodiesel. But based on some negotiations and information that was decided on at that time, it was passed at 2%. The idea with the 2% requirement was that it would take effect when, in fact, we were able to produce half of what we were needed within the state of Minnesota. That occurred in September of 2005. So since September of 2005, Minnesota has had the requirement of 2% biodiesel mix in there, and the diesel that is sold in this diesel fuel that's sold in the state of Minnesota. There has always been the, I think, the talk and the understanding that at some point we would look at going to a higher blend. However, we also knew that there were some issues that had to be addressed before that would take place. First of all, that first winter, we did have some problems with some of the quality that was produced. That was pretty much taken care of, and so by that the second and third winter that we've had this in place, most of those problems have, in fact, disappeared. It was this last summer at the Farm Fest that Governor Plenty announced that he was going to ask the legislature to consider going to a 20% by 2015 blend of biodiesel to be done incrementally. And as Senator Bickerman just talked about, some of those dates have been put in place. Well, certainly, initially, this legislation was looked at primarily as a rural economic development issue. we were having some serious issues with rural Minnesota and some of the farm commodity prices. And I think from all practical purposes, we've seen some dramatic changes because of some of our energy legislation that we've had in Minnesota. The other thing, though, that certainly has changed from where we were at that particular point is that we were not looking at oil at in excess of $100 a barrel like we are today. And so I think some of the impetus for looking at having the option to go to a higher blend of biodiesel in this case certainly gives us the opportunity to be less dependent on some of that foreign oil that we had at that we've even been in the past time. So from the standpoint of the Department of Agriculture and certainly from the governor's office, this is an important piece of legislation as it looks moving Minnesota ahead to continue to be not only a national but international leader in the renewable fuels area. It's important for the environment, as the senator mentioned. It's certainly important from the farm economy. But there are some provisions in this bill that I think are very important because it gives us the opportunity to make some changes along the way as they might be needed. And so there's been more flexibility with this legislation than what we even had in the first piece of legislation also. So, Mr. Chairman, members, on behalf of the administration, certainly want to express our support for Senator Vickerman's bill.
Thank you. Mr. Schoenfeld, correct?
Yes, thank you.
State your name for the record. Offer your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work both with the Minnesota Soybean Growers, who initiated this legislation some years ago for the original B2, and I work with the Minnesota Biodiesel Council, which are the manufacturing plants that produce the biodiesel in the state. There are four. Mr. Chairman, it's up to you. When it becomes a time in which there's enough of a quorum here to do it, I've talked with Senator Vickerman about a very small, which is pretty much a technical change, relative to the bill, very small amendment. So perhaps later we could come back to that and I'll describe it. But I guess what I'd like to talk about is a little bit about where we came from. When you consider when the original biodiesel legislation went through a number of years ago, although the Senate was a bit kinder to us, I think there was a total of 13 committees that we went through between the House and the Senate. It was very detailed in terms of the legislature's investigation into it, and it passed on a fairly close vote at that time. Since that time, biodiesel has been instituted into the fuel stream, and as the commissioner had indicated, the first year there were some problems. As I have gone around and talked to members of the committee about it, those problems in terms of perception, more than fact, have continued to plague the industry a bit by people bringing up certain kinds of issues. I'd like to talk a little bit about what has happened. For instance, when the original biodiesel legislation went through, there were no plants in Minnesota at all. Since that time, we now have 65 million gallons of production, which comes very close to meeting all of the requirements within the passage of this bill, particularly if it should stay so that it does not be blended in the winter times. Secondly, at the time the legislation was going through originally, ASTM standards were not available. Presently, we do have ASTM standards now. It's the Society for Testing of Materials, and we do have ASTM standards for B100. We have ASTM standards for 0 to 5%, and we expect soon to have ASTM standards for 6 to 20%. One of the provisions in the bill is that those standards must be in place, and those are quality assurance standards to ensure that the fuel is up to the quality that we need. Thirdly, nationwide, what Minnesota did back then has stemmed production capacity across this nation. We presently have about 1.5 billion gallons of production capacity in the nation. As I mentioned, 65 million gallons, I think, in Minnesota. So that the capacity is there to provide that. Another thing, at the time that the original bill was passed, there was not infrastructure in the state, places, or actually in any place, other than splash blending. Presently, all of the terminals within Minnesota do blend at the terminals, and that's a significant thing because it helps with some of the winter blending issues that we have. There are also terminals outside of Minnesota, a couple in Iowa, that have installed biodiesel injection equipment and blending equipment, and so they are working favorably. We do have one problem, however, and that is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. There is, outside of our borders, there is a plant or a terminal that does not have that blending equipment available. Part of what this legislation does is to try and provide some funds by redirecting some funds within the Department of Commerce to assist with some of those infrastructure kinds of issues to improve the quality that we have already improved upon. Beyond that, the specification for biodiesel, we do have plants now. All of the plants within Minnesota are what's called BQ9000 certified. For most of you, you might compare this to an ISO kind of a certification. And what it is not, although it does not certify the fuel, what it does do is certify the blending process and the plant's capability to carry on quality control within their plants in order to do a good job of producing biodiesel. All of these are changes that have taken place over the last couple of years. I point this out because I think if you kind of thought back to when Drake drilled his first oil well, I assume in the first couple of years after that, there probably was some problems with some of the crude oil production as well. We have come a very long way in a very short period of time in addressing quality issues, in addressing distribution issues, and also issues relative to educating the public as to how to deal with this fuel. With that in mind, I would also point out that most of the opposition to this type of legislation has disappeared. Initially, when this bill went through the first time, we had, I think at one time I counted 43 lobbyists that were working against this bill, and we had about three or four that were working in behalf of the bill. And at that time, the Truckers Association was in opposition, the railroads were in opposition, the Chamber of Commerce, the Taxpayers League. Petroleum marketers took a neutral position at that time. I can tell you now that I shouldn't speak for Mr. Krogman, but he's over the side, but the petroleum marketers are now supporting this bill with the changes that would be adopted under this amendment. In addition to that, we have support from Truckers Association and a number of others, at least not opposition, that presently do support the bill, and most of that kinds of opposition has fallen away. I would ask then, why has that happened? It's because we have improved the quality of the fuel. It's because we've made it work within the system, and biodiesel today is working. In addition to that, at the time that the bill originally passed, we had indicated that we would be working on the federal level in order to provide a dollar tax credit to approach to deal with some of the disparity in price that we had had. We did do that. In fact, that tax credit a year ago, I believe, or a year and a half ago, actually made biodiesel considerably cheaper at higher blends than diesel fuel. At the present time, there is a couple of cents increase because of biodiesel costs. But we see today that the price of crude oil is at above a dollar or $110 crude. And biodiesel, at least in the last week, has dropped now down to around 61 cents. And so it's hard to say what those things are going to be in the year 2012 or 2015. But I can tell you with federal incentives, and in addition to that, there is also language within this bill that does deal with the price disparity. It was put in at the request of the petroleum marketers, retailers that handle this fuel, and it provides a off-ramp in case something were to be out of line. My guess, however, by the time this higher blends takes place, we'll actually be an asset in terms of being lower in price than what diesel fuel. That's no crystal ball that I have for sure, but I think if you take a look at traditional historic rates, that may very well be the case. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would also, I'd like to very briefly address, because I know I've had questions from Senator Wergen, I've had questions from Senator Scoy and others about problems that have been there in the past, and I'd like to give you the resolution as to some of those problems. One of the things that you have to keep in context with regard to biodiesel is the fact that in the last 3 years, the entire fuel distribution system and fuel itself has changed dramatically. First of all, the federal government I'll start this way. With the biodiesel, we instituted the 2% mandate in Minnesota in September of 2005. However, that's not the only change that has taken place. Ultra-low sulfur diesel was required, I believe, in October of 2006. Beyond that, new engine manufacturers for diesel engine required by federal law are required required to be started to be put in place in January of 2007. The reason I bring this up is because the first year that we had the biodiesel production, we had some out-of-specification fuel that entered the marketplace, and it caused severe problems both in reality and also in terms of perception about biodiesel. Since that time, ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel has had its own set of problems. Some of the new engine situations have changed so that they've had their own set of problems, but we continue to kind of get the blame for all of it because we have biodiesel in the fuel. What's interesting about that is that sometimes we have run across where we have a hotline, for instance, that people can contact, and they say, oh, I have biodiesel in my fuel, I must have a problem. But they've been having it in the fuel for the past 3 years, and they never had a problem before that. So you say, well, how come you didn't have a problem before that? Well, I don't know, but I had a problem this time. Well, there are many reasons for problems in fuel. I tell you, first of all, and I'd like to address how all of these have been dealt with. One is improper blending. One of the problems that you can have with biodiesel is that when you blend biodiesel at a different temperature than the diesel fuel itself, it doesn't blend properly in some cases. Now, that's not a problem in the summertime, but in the wintertime, when you have cold weather diesel fuel that is sitting out there, and if you were to try to dump biodiesel in to meet the 2% mandate, which is the case in splash blending in some cases, it doesn't work very well. Because of that, that's why some of the inline terminal blending has taken place and so forth, and the entire distribution system is learning how to deal with all that, and I think they have now at this point dealt with it pretty well. But we do still have one problem in southwestern Minnesota, as I said, where we cannot get because of the Sioux Falls distribution into the state. So that will be continued to be worked on. Secondly, ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel itself. There have been found that paraffin crystals in the ultra-low sulfur has dropped out in a greater degree than what was in the old diesel fuel. Beyond that, there was one other thing that probably was not initially accounted for enough, and that was that biodiesel in itself, like ethanol was in the beginning, is a solvent. And because of it being a solvent, it cleans engines, and it cleans fuel lines, and it cleans up the distribution system itself. So because of that, quite frankly, in some cases right now, it is recommended that biodiesel be put in at 100% with the first run through an engine, and then after that to go back to the 2% or the 5% in order to really clean it out the first time, get rid of the first fuel filter, and then change it. So my point of all of this, there's also, I might also mention that water in tanks and so forth, fuel, it has to be handled to a much higher level of just has to be handled better today than it was in years past. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to kind of stop if there's any questions about any comments I may have made. But all of this, for instance, there's a lot of talk about cloud point and things like that. Biodiesel at 2 or 5% makes almost no difference in the fuel system. However, there is differences at higher blends depending upon the type of fuel blended, the percentage of number one and number two, the additives that are added, and a number of other things. But we are confident that the fuel system suppliers can work all of this out, and I believe others are as well.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. We will take some questions of members.
Mr. Chair, before
Senator
you
Rickerman.
Do that, can I have Mr. Hugesson go to another two important parts of this delete all amendment, and then we will go into that?
Sure. Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, you know, one of the things that has been very consistent with what we've done with biodiesel is that...
Hold off one second. We now do have a quorum. Let that be noted for the record. Maybe we'll go ahead and move your amendment and have that officially before us.
And Mr. Chair, if the quorum is present, I would move the A3 amendment. To get the bill in order, I'd like to have it.
Senator Vickerman moves the A3 author's amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, one of the things that we have done along the way with biodiesel is we created what was referred to as the Biodiesel Task Force, and this has been a mix of all the parties interested in the issue of biodiesel that have met as needed to discuss implementation of the law in the first place, and then more recently brought together following the governor's suggestion to how this legislation might be crafted. And so this group has consistently met since last fall to talk about various issues. One of the provisions you'll note in the bill is Section 4 under the technical cold weather issues, is talking about the idea of having stakeholders that are experts in cold weather biodiesel to be able to consider and make recommendations in any way that the biodiesel adding on here is going to be handled. And so the idea behind here is that we will have a technical panel, be it the biodiesel task force or some compilation of various technical experts that will be available to pull together the information. And the idea behind this is that we want to make sure that everybody that's affected by this along the way has input into the process in terms of how this is addressed, so that if, in fact, we sense some problems or some things that are not perhaps what they ought to be, they can be providing the technical expertise that will be needed to make some of the decisions as we move ahead with implementation of a higher blend.
Okay. Commissioner, did you have an amendment to...
Mr. Chairman, members, that is included in the delete all that you have in
so
front of
us. So you're just speaking to the A3 that we just
yes,
adopted.
I'm sorry. Yes, the okay. Section 4. There is the Senator Vickerman
Senate
just asked.
Council does have a technical amendment to also add to the A3 amendment, if we could hear that quickly.
Mr. Chairman, and I realize there may be other technical amendments we want to add, but while you're on this section, it's just a suggestion. But on page 4, line 1, you may want to – you could delete technical – and then on page 4, line 2, before experts, insert technical. I think you're talking about stakeholders who are technical experts rather than people who are technically stakeholders.
Yeah, Senator Vickerman, that meet with your approval?
Mr. Chair, we'll incorporate that into my...
He needs to move it now.
You've got to move it. We already adopted it.
Okay, so Senator Vickerman moves the oral amendment as described by Senator by Council Bodern. Everyone understand that amendment?
Mr. Chairman, could just while you're here.
Okay.
I didn't know if convening a technical group of stakeholders would get you into a state and local government issue or not. I was thinking the other option would be to, instead of convene, consult with.
Well, if sort of let me know.
So it'd be consult with technical stakeholders who are consult with stakeholders who are technical experts.
Maybe Mr. Bodern could. I think that probably would be wise advice given our deadline is tomorrow. Maybe Council could read what it should, how it should read now then.
Mr. Chairman, on page 4, line 1, delete convene technical and insert consult with. And on page 4, line 2, after R, insert technical. So it would read, the Commissioners of Agriculture and Commerce shall consult with stakeholders who are technical experts in cold weather biodiesel, et cetera.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll also incorporate that into the delete all amendment.
Does everyone, well, the delete all has been adopted, so we're making an amendment to the bill.
Your amendment
is before
us.
Yeah. Everyone understand the amendment? Any discussion of it? Seeing none, all those in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Now, Mr. Chair, I have one small technical amendment. Two. Mr. Schoenfeld's going to explain it.
Mr. Schoenfeld?
Suggest this. If you take a look at page 219, this is in the pricing mechanism. And what it says, the biodiesel price determined after the $1 per gallon credit is subtracted to biodiesel plant. Recognize that this bill goes out in 2015. That dollar credit is a federal tax credit. It's presently up for renewal this year in December. By December 31st of this year, it has already been renewed a couple of times, and we expect it to be renewed by Congress again. But here's the suggestion I would make. After the word credit, you would insert or other credits or incentives, then strike is. Suggestion, but basically what I'm trying to say here is that even though that credit exists as a dollar right now, it could change in the future, which would affect the price of the biodiesel, and so we're trying to give a little more flexibility to that sentence.
Catch that, Greg.
I didn't catch all of it. Mr. Chairman?
Could we get you to repeat that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, would another alternative be just to strike the dollar per gallon so that after the federal credit is subtracted?
Right.
just to leave it.
Mr. Chairman, the only suggestion I have about that is that we don't know what type. There have been changes in the last couple of years about what type of credits and so forth. They've accomplished the same thing, but as you might remember with ethanol, from blender's credits to rebates to the different things, and so I'd just like to see as much flexibility as possible because you're not
Mr.
certain
Schoenfeld,
it's going to be that same
credit. I think
that's
what we're trying to insert. If we just say, and the biodiesel price determined after the federal credits, and you said and something else.
I suppose there could be a state credit as well.
Or incentives.
Incentives.
That would give us the flexibility without referencing what's currently in federal law.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you also mentioned the state, that there could be a state one. So would you want to just say after credits and incentives are subtracted?
Mr. Karnoff, could you read what the sentence would?
Well, I'll just start on 2.19. And the biodiesel price determined after credits and incentives are subtracted. So you would delete everything after on line 2.19, and then insert credits and incentives are.
Everyone understand that amendment? Senator Vickerman, that meets with your approval.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move that. I'll include that in my amendment.
We're taking these one at a time, acting on them. Everyone understand the amendment as it is? Any discussion of it? All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. All right, and then we did have some questions, I believe, for Mr. Schoenfeld. Senator Skoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this really is going to be more of a comment than a question. And I wanted to make it while Mr. Schoenfeld and Commissioner Hugesson were here. And Senator Vickerman, as you know, I had a bill that was actually on the agenda for today that I withdrew because I think we've got the problems resolved. But I do have I did have concerns about the winter flow issue of biodiesel, and I'm glad to see that you are proposing a winter exemption when you get above 5%. Mr. Schoenfeld has talked about the problems with the ultra-low sulfur fuel, and farmers and loggers and construction people have to understand that our fuel is not the same as it used to be, and we have to do a lot more maintenance because if you get any water in there, the paraffin does drop out, and it gets on the bottom of the tank, and it goes into the filters, and it plugs it, and it's not related to the biodiesel. And so I want to put that on the record, that is an ultra-low sulfur issue. And I hope that this works. I'm strongly supportive. I think Minnesotans, despite the issue of whether it might be a little price increase with biodiesel, they'd much prefer to leave those dollars in the Midwest and sending them off to the Mideast for crude oil. So I think this is a real good initiative. I do have a couple of things that I want people to be concerned about as we go ahead. One of the things that it looks to me like happens as we've moved toward this ultra-low sulfur and biodiesel fuel, the percentage of number one that people are running in the wintertime has gone up. I think we used to run a 40-60 or a 50-50 blend. Now we're running a 50-50 or a 60-40 blend. We do not have enough diesel fuel in the state of Minnesota in the wintertime if we have to go any higher than that. And this is a concern that as a state we need to be paying attention to because we can't have fuel gelling problems in the wintertime. And it's not biodiesel. And you're right, Mr. Schoenfeld, you've been taking the blame for something that isn't yours there. But as a state, we need to be thinking about what's going on. And so we need to be concerned about that. And then the winter, the blending in the wintertime is a big issue. It has to be done well or it isn't going to work. We know that this splash blending is not good. We think there might be some of that going on up along the border. We need to be aware of that. And I wish you well on your journeys with this bill. I hope we can get it passed into law. I do have one other thought, Senator Vickerman, that I would hope occurs. I think there might be some efforts to put some exemptions in to this bill. And I would hope that up to the 5% level, we wouldn't do that, because I think that that will really weaken the bill and also demonstrate that there are issues that we don't think are there at this time. But in the future, if we do have these issues, we will have to come back and look at it. But I am strongly supportive of your initiative, Senator Vickerman, and I hope we can pass this into law.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Senator Scoy, I share your concern. I happened to have a cabin up there, and I was up there when they were putting that big pipeline in, and they were having some trouble there. But I think what we're going to try to help with that is on page 3 it starts, and then to the next page, we're going to have a group of experts look and see if there's something we need to do. Rather than just me or the legislators, we want to be sure we have a group, and that hopefully will work for your concern. Because one thing we don't want to do is discourage the use of it. Then we lost everything we gained.
Very good, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Schoenfeld?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify something just to be fair to all parties. When I talked about the ultra-low sulfur thing as an example, I'm not trying to blame ultra-low sulfur for all problems either. Suggesting to you is that there have been many changes in the entire fuel situation, and collectively there have been problems that have come up. So I didn't want to I don't want to be blamed. We sometimes have had biodiesel problems that have caused problems, and I want to make that clear. But at the same time, there have been other reasons as well. And so I didn't mean to disparage anybody else's fuel or anything like that, but there are just a collective number of reasons that things sometimes go wrong.
And that's what I'd heard you say. Senator Scoy.
Yes, and just quickly, I don't want to take a lot of time, but one of the issues with ultra-low sulfur fuel is the sulfur-killed organisms that grows in diesel fuel. So now we've had some issues with the green stuff growing in the tanks, and it's being blamed on biodiesel. It's not related to biodiesel. It's related to the fact that the sulfur is no longer in the fuel killing these organisms. So as farmers or anybody else, if you're planning on having diesel fuel stored on your farm or wherever for any length of time, we have to be aware that you have to put an additive in there to kill that organism. There's going to be more maintenance on our fuel than there used to be in the past. And we need to have an active education effort, and I think that the fuel retailers are going to be part of this, to educate the public about the changes that have occurred. It's not a good, bad us against them or anything. It's just what's going on. And people need to know that these are maintenance items now that we might not have had to do in the past, but we have to do them now.
And I'd say we either maintain our fuel or maintain our equipment.
Mr. Chair, I have two more witnesses. If I could bring them forward this
sure.
time.
Mr. Peterson and Megan McDaniel. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Doug Peterson. I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. And we are here today to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Farmers Union membership in full support of Senator Vickerman, the chairman's bill on biodiesel, which would increase the state mandate. Minnesota Farmers Union policy is set by our membership at a grassroots level, and we had many resolutions this year from our county convention that were passed supporting this legislation. Our members are strong believers in biodiesel and also voted this as one of our top priorities for the legislative session in 08 this year. Minnesota Farmers Union is also part owners of the Farmers Union Industries biofuels plant in Redwood Falls, is the first plant to produce biodiesel toward the current state mandate. I also was co-author of the biofuels house provision in 2002, and I currently serve as chair of the Farmers Union Industry, a co-op which owns 6 agribusiness enterprises within the state of Minnesota. I currently also serve on the board of the biodiesel task force, and we have worked together to move this legislation forward. The objective of this legislation is to use biodiesel at all levels, and I would strongly encourage the committee to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Ms. McDaniel?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, members of the committee. My name is Megan McDaniel, and I'm with Flint Hills Resources. As you know, we are a refinery in Rosemount, Minnesota, and we produce much of the gas and diesel distributed in Minnesota. I want to thank the author and the governor's office and that we've been working together just to work out some of the issues and concerns that we've had. Flint Hills did also have a member on the biodiesel task force after the Senate, after the governor suggested going to 20%. And many of our concerns have been addressed concerning cold weather and certain levels, as well as some options for what a cold weather standard would be. Currently, there is no cold weather ASTM standard for biodiesel, and so that was one of our concerns. I wanted to get on the record and let people know that at 5% biodiesel, we've worked very hard to make 2% work, and we will work very hard to make 5% work. We know that we're headed in that direction, but at 5% biodiesel, we won't be able to sell our number one diesel product, which is Arctic diesel, because we are still concerned about the cold flow properties in biodiesel. Like I said, that's a number one product of ours, and we're still concerned, but we will continue to work. One other product that we think should be considered to meet the 20% mandate, and we expressed this at the Biodiesel Council, is the inclusion of possibly a renewable diesel. Similar feedstocks, agricultural feedstocks, soy, canola, animal fats, but it's run through a hydrotreater, and that hydrotreater allows the diesel product that comes out to look very similar to, or it looks like a diesel product and would meet diesel ASTM. We think at beyond 5%, that is something that should be considered to increase the market and to increase the capability of getting to 20%. Finally, we know that there is a biodiesel mandate both at the federal and the local level. We will continue to blend biodiesel, and we think that not only us but other people might like to produce renewable diesel. So we wanted to enter that into the record and to have that be part of the conversation as renewable fuels continue in the legislature. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. McDaniel. Any questions of members for these two witnesses? Seeing none.
If there's no Senator questions, then, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2724, as amended, be recommended to pass, and it has to go to Finance.
Okay. Let me ask quickly before we take that up. Anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor of or in opposition to Senate File 2724?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr.
Senator
Schoenfeld
Vickerman
wants to say one more word.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just want to speak a little, just very briefly, because it may come up a long way as this is going. There are no amendments today or anything, but we do have some concerns about the renewable diesel that was just talked about. And I do want to make it clear that renewable diesel and biodiesel are not the same thing. The definition in this bill and the definition on our existing law defines what biodiesel is. Just so that they sound an awful lot alike, but they're not the same thing. As we've gone through a whole testing period, both in terms of testing up front and also kind of in the field with biodiesel, there are similar concerns that some people have about renewable diesel. At the present time, to my knowledge, there is no commercial renewable diesel being produced in the United States. If I'm wrong about that, I need to be corrected, but to my knowledge, at least, there is none at this time. Secondly, there is no production facility at the present time exactly that is doing that. One of the concerns we have is that when this bill was originally passed, it dealt with economic development, particularly in rural areas. We would believe that that would severely damage that aspect of the advantages that we see for rural Minnesota in particular, because it wouldn't likely be out in the Brewster plant in southwestern Minnesota as such. In addition to that, one of the advantages of biodiesel is that for every gallon of biodiesel that you add into the fuel, you also add additional refining capacity. Depending upon the process used, that may or may not be true of renewable diesel. And so what I would ask, I guess, and I have a number of other concerns I'd raise, and I think as people would consider it, they would raise those as well. And what I would ask, at least, as the bill goes through the process, that we maintain it as biodiesel, that there may be another day, another time, in which renewable diesel is the appropriate thing to do. And at that time, I think that the legislature would want to look at that. But for this particular bill, we would prefer that we would stay with the biodiesel.
Mr. Schoenbaum, maybe you could enlighten me just a little bit. I mean, biodiesel fuel, we have in Subdivision 1 the definition, which means renewable, biodegradable, monoalkyl, derived from ag and other plants, oils, animals, fats. What is it about renewable diesel that is different than this definition?
Mr. Chairman, the section that says monoalkyl ester is what defines biodiesel. It's the process by which it's made. It's not just the way in which it comes, the feedstock that it comes from, but it's the monoalkyl ester is the definition of biodiesel.
Thank you for that clarification. So we now have Senator Vickerman's motion that Senate File 2724, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to finance before us. Anyone have any comments or questions on that? Seeing none, all in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair Vickerman. And members of the committee. As long as I'm down here, I have one more, and it'd be Senate File 3633.
Whoa. I think...
No.
2983 would maybe be
2983,
better.
I should say. I'm getting confused.
That's
just
all
like
right.
People are on diesel.
I'm confused, too.
2983, uh-huh. Pesticide fertilizer registration permit. I have Mr. Lamont.
What's it? Oh.
Lamont. Department of Ag will help me go through the bill. Mr. Chair, it's just a simple bill. In essence, if you have a license in another state and you get in trouble in another state, you can't come over to Minnesota and going through all the regulations and get certified again. Am I close? Okay. Maybe you can explain it fast.
Mr. Lamont, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Lamont with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I work in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division, and I have enforcement responsibilities. The bill in front of you would be an additional piece of language to add to our enforcement toolbox, which essentially would let us reject out-of-state persons from coming here who have a history of violation of the pesticide laws, either in the state from which they come or with the U.S. EPA. Increasingly, applicators are moving from one state to another when the work demands are here. They approach Minnesota, and we would like to be able to refuse certain people, or if they do get licensed, we'd like to be able to suspend that license once we learn of their behavior problems elsewhere.
Mr. Lamont, how would you find out about infractions in other states? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, it's a good question. We have an association called the Association of American Pesticide Control Officials. We have regular meetings, and we have continuous routine contacts between states.
So this is something that currently you do have information and have no ability to act on information received?
Mr. Chair, indeed, that's the case.
Okay. Any questions of members?
Well, Mr. Chair, if there's no questions, I would move that Senate File 2983 be recommended pass and be referred to the floor.
Okay. We have Senator Vickerman's motion before us. Anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2983? Seeing none, we have Senator Vickerman's motion that Senate File 2983 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Any discussion of that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you,
Mr. Chair, thank you and thank committee. We'll move right into Senator Lori. Do you want to switch positions with
me?
And
Paul, maybe you can stay right there. We have a handout for this one.
Here it is.
So we're here with Senate File 3326. Whenever we're ready. Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, Senator Lurie.
All right. Thank you. This is this bill increases the required documentation and modifies the deadline for persons to apply to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture for reimbursement of costs incurred to clean up ag chemical, fertilizer, and pesticide spills. MDA currently oversees an ag chemical response and reimbursement account that was created by the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act. And the act is funded, many of us are familiar with it, but it's funded by a surcharge on pesticide and fertilizer registrants, dealers, and applicators currently. And the Agricultural Chemical Compensation Board may pay reimbursable expenses to eligible persons for up to 80% of the cleanup costs, and account funds are also available to the MDA for its incident response and administrative costs. This bill does a couple of things. It requires a person to submit any invoices along with their application for payment or reimbursement, and it requires a person to submit these invoices and the application for payment or reimbursement within 3 years of performing the eligible cleanup work, or 3 years after the MDA approves the person's related action, design, or plan for the cleanup work, whichever is later. So it's a technical cleanup bill to better oversee this fund, and Paul Lamont from the Department of Agriculture is here again to answer any questions you may have. Again, there's a handout that also steps through the provisions of this bill.
Are there any questions for Senator Lurie? Mr. Lamont, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Lamont again. It is as exactly as described. It's a technical bill to clarify a certain provision that administratively has been at issue. The staff to the ACRA account think this will make their job easier. Applicants that are coming before the board for reimbursement, it'll make their expectations clear. And the board itself and its chair have written a letter of support for this bill.
Any further questions? Senator Lurie, where does this bill have to go now?
I believe this one can go to the floor. Is that correct? So I would so move that Senate File 3326 be recommended to pass. Period.
And referred to the floor.
Yep.
Any discussion on that motion? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, could I just ask Mr. Lamont, do you still need the lines 1.21 to 1.22, or is that just leftover language that isn't needed anymore? It seems like the dates have gone by a while ago.
Mr. Chair, Council, a quick glance at it indicates to me an agreement with what you're offering, but I wouldn't want to ask for you to delete that until I check with the ACRA board staff.
Okay, and any other...
I guess my motion would still stand, yes, and if they wanted such an amendment, I could offer it on the floor. Yeah. I don't think it would create a great deal of controversy to do so. So my motion would still stand.
Any further discussion on this motion? All in favor of Senator Lurie's motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Senator Lurie, you've got Senate File 3327.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Take up Senate File 3327. This is another largely technical department bill. I'll step you through it section by section. It is a little bit longer than the last one. I've also got Heidi Kassenberg from the Department of Ag available to answer any questions. Section 1 really creates a definition of vending machine. Section 2 covers license fees and penalties, and it authorizes the state to collect delinquent license fees if a firm has gone multiple years without paying required food handler license fees. They don't have this authority right now. And it requires certain licensed food handlers to include the value of services provided when determining the appropriate license fee. That's pretty much just bringing it in line with current practice. Section 3 deals with disaster areas, and it allows the Department of Ag to waive the fee and expedite a food handler plan review if the governor declares a disaster area. And Section 4, the annual fee exceptions, expands the mandatory state inspection fee from coin-operated to all food vending machines as defined in Section 1, and it adds water dispensing machines serviced by a cashier to the list of machines exempt from the state inspection fee, while still allowing local units of government to pass ordinances requiring inspections and inspection fees if they so choose. Section 5 deals with the grading of eggs. It requires the department to adopt and apply the grade weight quality standards issued by the USDA, and it removes language grandfathering in certain older egg equipment that is no longer really in use today. And it lowers the allowable temperature of eggs sold at retail from 45 to 41 degrees, and it disallows the sale of shell eggs that have been frozen unless the MDA explicitly authorizes it. Section 6 deals with embargoes and condemnations. It defines animal and expands the MDA's embargo condemnation authority to include adulterated or misbranded animals. Section 7 deals with employment of diseased person. It removes venereal disease from the list of ailments that disqualify someone from working with food products. Section 8 deals with water, plumbing, and sewage. Requires a person handling food products to have a water supply system that meets standards promulgated by the Departments of Health, Pollution Control, and Labor and Industry. Previously, the water system had to be up to code and in compliance with pollution control rules only. And I'm also reminded I would like to move, I think, an author's amendment that Senator Dill has. It was added in the House as well, another technical provision that the department would like to see move with this bill. I don't have a copy of that. Yeah. But
Mr. Chairman, members.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, it's really what it is Senate File 3651, which you'll see further down the list. It deals with goat's milk. My state representative, Ron Szymanski, has brought this legislation forward, and as I understand it, there is some issue about somatic cell count, and it's typically has a higher level than we have in cattle, and there's some prohibition on processing milk and goat's milk in Minnesota if it has more than 1.5 million cells per milliliter of. But I think Dr. Kassenberg, you understand this goat's milk issue, I understand. Is that right? Well, maybe you can explain it to the committee.
Yes, Senator Dill. My name is Dr. Heidi Kassenberg. I'm the division director for the Dairy and Food Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Senator Dill, yes, that is correct. We regarding goat milk, there's 1,500 cells per milliliter is one that is consistent with that in Wisconsin. So right now we have an economic disadvantage for producers in Minnesota. Most milk of this quality goes for manufacturing, meaning cheese production. There still is a grade A standard that needs to be met. That's 1,000, and that's for fluid goat milk. Right now we only have one producer that's producing goat milk at a grade A, or also you would know that as fluid goat milk, the goat milk that you can get and drink. So that we only have one producer producing goat milk for consumption. The rest is being used for cheese. So this 1,500 would just make this similar to Wisconsin's and other states, surrounding states as well. 1.5 million okay. Would be the same, yeah.
Fair deal.
Okay, so what I want, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Kassenberg, I want to try to understand this a little bit better. If you have a goat producer here in Minnesota that is producing goat's milk and selling it off the farm or producing cheese on the farm, Is he allowed to do that under our current law? I mean, or is it an issue of him having to export it to another state, or how does that? I don't quite follow you.
They can use it for cheese, or they can send it across state lines as well. But our standard is they can't sell it at all if it's over a million.
Okay, so by raising it to a million and a half,
amend his whole.
And is that where goat's milk typically is? More like at a million and a half.
Well, you do run into quality issues once you get the higher Hispanic cell counts. But that's up to really what more of a processor issue. It's not a milk safety issue.
Okay.
It's really more of a quality.
So if the milk is over a million cells per milliliter, then he has to. The market is outside the state. Is that?
Or inside the state if they want to produce cheese from that. Yeah.
Okay. So it's either in-state cheese production or give it to Wisconsin.
Or cheese production there as well. Yes.
Okay. So. Yep. Anyway, I would like to move this Senate File 3651 as an amendment to Senate File 3327.
Senator Rhodes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either Senator Dale or Dr. maybe have the answer to this. And I don't know anything about somatic cells in goat's milk. So is it an indicator for, like, bacteria or... You said it's linked to quality. I'm not sure why we're measuring it even.
I mean, yes, it has to do with quality. There are goats are significantly different from cattle in that their somatic cells can vary by season, and especially in the fall, they are raised or just as a part of their normal reproductive cycle. It has, for goats, it may have something to do with infection sometimes, but for the most part, a lot of goat's milk will have normally high somatic cells that has nothing to do with any sorts of infection at all. But it can affect the ability to produce cheese because it can interfere with the organisms that are used to make cheese. So it can interfere with that. So they might need more of a particular organism or different types of processing with that. And also the off flavors in milk can, spoilage can occur faster with higher somatic cell counts. But since everything's pasteurized, it's not a milk quality issue. It's not a food safety issue, it's a quality issue.
Senator Lurie?
Having just seen this for the first time really myself too, I think I understood that we were raising the limit from 1 million to 1.5 million, and I'm just curious, mm-hmm. This is all new language, and I'm wondering where the old 1 million, I don't see it deleted anywhere or removed, and I'm just curious how that plays out technically.
Senator, I can answer that question as well. We adopt what's known as the pasteurized milk ordinance, which is something that in order to sell milk across state lines, we have to meet. And so because we adopt that, it's in those regulations that determine as far as selling for grade A milk. And so then this would actually just exempt us from that particular portion for, because they really are silent as far as grade B milk.
So... is that a rule we're exempting from, or is it a law?
That would be only if they maximum cell count.
Maybe council would have some advice as to whether this actually does what we intend it to do, given a limit elsewhere.
Mr. Knopf.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just looking for the reference, but I know that the pasteurized milk ordinance, it's basically incorporated by law, but it's a federal rule that's incorporated by law. It's in the same chapter as this. So what you've done is you adopted the entire pasteurized milk ordinance that's produced by the federal government, and then what you're doing here is carving this back, saying we've adopted all except this one. We're going to be a little bit less different standard than the federal pasteurized milk ordinance.
So this
works.
This does work.
Mr. Chairman,
that's what
Senator
I was trying
Lurie,
to get at. Thank you.
Senator Dale, you understand it? You know, it would have been a lot easier if you had brought some goat milk. Last time we had the dairy people here, we had yogurt.
We wouldn't have been able to drink it just yet. We need to get this cleared up first.
Let me ask. I want to ask Dr. Kassenberg, is this a good idea?
This is something that you know, we've discussed with the author in the House, and we have no problem with it.
Finance, right?
You have to double.
I better ask him. You think it's workable?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Okay. Senator Deal.
Well, I will renew my motion to add this to Senator Lurie's bill.
Okay. Everybody understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Well adopted. Now, I'm going to ask you, in this bill, is there money involved? If it is, it's going to have to go to finance. In the total, the whole bill.
In the whole bill? There can be. It all depends upon if there's a governor's declared disaster. Because if that occurs, we would lose some plan review fees.
Well, and there's some fees, the ability to go collect fees from vending operations that. So there's some fee work in here. It probably should go to
that. That we consider to be neutral, because it's an as vending machine operators upgrade from coin operation to credit cards, those who used to be coin operated will now become credit card operated. And in the previous language, it did not cover explicitly credit card usage.
Well, then, Senator Lurie, fiscal experts are telling me this has to go to finance. There's some financial obligation. So why don't we, if we move it, send it to finance, and then we can...
If we discover that there's no fiscal note, we can re-refer it. I'm comfortable with that.
Well, Senator, what's your wishes?
I'd move that Senate File 3327, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance.
Okay. Any discussion? Senator Deal?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to have Dr. Kassenberg look on page 9, line 13. Senator Lurie, if you can look on the same line there. Mr. Knopf.
What line? I'm sorry.
13.
Okay.
Mr. Knopf drew it to my attention that we have both horses and equines listed there. And the question is do we need both?
All right. Who drafted this?
Although there's not a lot of donkey slaughter, I guess we can.
Why not just equine?
And since it's going to be outlawed federally, I guess we can just strike equines. That's fine.
Or strike horses.
Or we could just strike horses. That's fine.
Would equines include donkeys?
We would consider that to be a part of that.
Okay, well, that's good to know, because the other question that came up was other large domesticated animals, and all I could think about were elephants. So that means we have a symbol for both political parties covered.
Well, I'm going to withdraw my motion to recommend 3327 as amended, I guess, and adopt... I'm going to move that we strike horses, comma, from page 9, line 13.
Everybody understand that? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So adopted. Now, Lurie, any more?
I'm going to move that Senate File 3327, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Lurie moves that Senate File 3327 as amended be recommended to pass, and we'll send it to finance, and you can decide between finance and...
Yeah, we'll take care of that. We'll look into the...
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Skye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here today with two bills that deal with the control of bovine tuberculosis. I think we'll start with Senate File 3725, which is a bill. Well, first, I'm assuming all the members know that we have had a fourth positive test in Minnesota. It's very likely going to lose its another level of accreditation for handling with bovine TB, which is going to result in a significant number of animals needed to be tested in Minnesota in order to move animals out across state lines. One of the outcomes of this additional testing is that there is very likely going to be an application into USDA to split the state into two separate zones for different levels of status. For a long time, I had not been supportive of that, but with the practicality of actually having to face with all the costs related to these testing, I've come around to support this provision. 3725 is the bill that would give the board the authority to split the state into two sections and proceed with the USDA. I do have an amendment that I would like to offer to 3725. I talked to Dr. Hartman about this. I believe he supported. So I'd like to offer the A1 amendment. This is a amendment that would try to keep this split-off zone as small as possible. It designates the zone to be no more than 201 herds. The reason for that is current federal USDA rules are 201 herds there in the process of revising their rules, which might require a larger split-off area. And I'd like to keep this as small as possible, and we'll get to I'll be happy to talk about that now, or I certainly will touch on it at a later time today. But I'd like to offer the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment.
Senator Scorey, maybe we should hear from your witness, and then we'll decide.
Well, Mr. Chair, okay. This is the first stop for this bill, and I'd like to get this bill in the shape that I'd like first, so I'd like to offer the A1 amendment if I could, please. I'd like it incorporated so he can talk about the size
of
the split-up.
Do you want to put this on the bill to get it the way you want it?
Yes, okay. I do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scorey moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill is in order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll turn it over to Dr. Hartman to talk about the split state status in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. As Senator Scoey mentioned, this bill would provide the Board of Animal Health the necessary authority to split the state into two different zones. And what we're proposing to do is have a zone as small as we can possibly make it, but yet are able to control the disease up in northwestern Minnesota as a modified accredited zone, and then propose that the rest of the state be accredited free. I've had several conference calls with USDA to discuss that, and those are options that are out there. The proposed area that we've talked about so far with them contains about 300 herds, but we are still discussing the size of that area. And Senator Scoey hit it exactly right. With this drop in status, there will be a lot of unnecessary testing and a lot of expense in the rest of the state, and so we want to make sure we can move this ahead as fast as possible. We need these resources up where the disease is, and if you remember, we've done statewide surveillance of our cattle herds and our deer, white-tailed deer, and shown that there isn't any disease in any other part of the state. It's a very small area up in northwestern Minnesota. And I think that's important. We've told we've had numerous meetings up in the northwestern part of the state, and we are committed to getting not only splitting the state with these resources and this authority, but eliminating the infection up there. We want to make sure that DNR and the Board of Animal Health are working together to get rid of this disease in both the white-tailed deer and the cattle.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Knopf has brought to my attention that my A1 amendment does exactly the opposite of what I intended it to do, so I have an oral amendment.
Mr. Chairman, something was lost in the translation, I think. Mr. Chairman, the
The A1 amendment, the suggested amendment to get it to the way Senator Scoy described it, would be on 1.3 after contain, insert not more than, and then delete or more. So it would read the board may designate tuberculosis zones that contain not more than 201 herds.
I would move that amendment, please.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill should be in order.
Well, Mr. Chair, did we take out the First Amendment then?
No.
Close.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, what we did, the amendment as drafted would have required the area to be split off to be larger than 201 herds, and I want it to be smaller than. Mm-hmm. So we changed the language so that it's smaller.
Senator Scogin?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just to help Senator Scogin with that, the motion was to amend the previously adopted A1 amendment. So what he did is just amend the amendment to the bill.
Thank you.
Senator Deal.
Mr. Chairman, members, or Dr. Hartman or Senator Scoy, where did the number 201 come from?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, that is the current USDA standard or smallest size for split state status.
And did you tell me there were 50-some herds in that area?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, there are 56 herds in the DNR bovine TB management zone for control of bovine TB in deer.
Hartman?
Maybe I can, Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, maybe I can shed some light on that. DNR has established a core zone, and that's an area where the deer that we've been finding infected are, and then a buffer zone around that. That's the management area. Those two areas contain 56 herds, but this area that we're talking about as a split state, a modified accredited area, would actually contain right now in our projections about 300 herds. So it's a bigger area than that management area.
Senator Scoy.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, what my hope is with I've got the Senate file 3728 that we're going to get to. But if we can pass and adopt Senate File 3728, which is a herd buyout proposal for those 56 herds, that if we do that and we send Dr. Hartman off to USDA to negotiate the size of this split state status, that we're going to get it down pretty close to that smaller area. Now, I don't know if we can do that or not, but that's my goal in making this the designation that I have.
Well, I have a lot of confidence in Dr. Hartman, Mr. Chairman, and so I don't know if it. I hope it makes a difference to pass a law that indicates the legislature is behind that. So I support what you're trying to do. I think it's a good idea.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, Dr. Hartman and I have talked about this as whether it was a good idea to do this or not. He thinks it does strengthen his hand with USDA, so that's part of the reason we're doing this.
Senator Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scoy and Dr. Hartman, just so I understand this a little bit better when I'm talking to my folks back home, because actually, since I'm in the southeastern corner of the state, they are keeping their eye on the northwestern corner. And I have heard from a lot of my cattlemen that they really do favor a split division, and you can understand why. But can you talk to me a little bit about the, again, not the number of 101 herds, but why are we going by herd number rather than total head population? Is that because... Or do those herds have to be geographically separated by a certain number of miles to be considered a separate herd? Or help me understand
Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson-Ropes, my understanding is we are trying to work within the USDA guidelines and in their rules for split state status, they count herds. Now, the current rule is 201. They have some proposed rules that is 1,000 herds, and we're trying not to do that because that gets to be a real large area. And this bill is giving Dr. Hartman the authority to apply for split state status with USDA. The next bill that I have is going to get into a lot more details and a lot more issues dealing with how the state is going to deal with bovine TB and how we're going to eradicate it.
So just to follow up, Mr. Chair, again, is there a geographic number of or a distance between herds? Because we have two neighbors that have a fence abutting both sides, you know, and the herds kind of mingle around the same area. Are they still considered two separate herds or one herd because of geographic area? He's going to move. Or does there need to be like 10 miles between herds so that is a comfortable amount of space that you can assume that the infection hasn't jumped from one herd to the next? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, the Code of Federal Regulations doesn't specify a size for the zone. There is veterinary services memorandums that talk about this 201 as being the minimum size and suggest that it should be 1,000 herds. That's what we're negotiating with them on, and it does not specify space or any other factor. It's simply the number of herds. And it's based on that you can only have a certain percentage of infection in an area, and so the denominator is important for that number. As far as how do you draw that line and how do you decide who's in and who's out, we're working on that. But I think any cattle operation that has any facility within that area would be included in that area.
Any other questions? Senator Scogin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think everybody in this room understands what a big deal this is, but I don't know if the state of Minnesota understands it yet. And I just want to thank Senator Scoy for doing the work in an area where he has not always been well received with the message. But he stayed with it, and he's put together two pretty good bills here. And I think the conversations are going to continue with some of the people that live up in that area. But I'm just going to, Senator Scoy, for my cattle producers, they're more concerned about pasture rent. Because if we start destroying herds, there may become some pasture available. And they're asking questions about people in this area that may want to move their cattle out of the area. And if there's pasture available up there, if they're going to be allowed to take their healthy cattle up there. And if maybe that's in your next bill, maybe that's in this one, and whenever you want to respond to that, that's fine.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, I'll start now, and maybe Dr. Hartman can help me with some of the technical details of your question. If we are able to do a herd buyout in that area, part of the buyout is that they will not be allowed to put animals back on that pasture until we're bovine TB free. I mean, that's the reason to do the herd buyout is to reduce the interface between cattle and deer. I mean, that's the reason. So they won't be allowed to rent that land for pasture. Now, if there's areas where, we don't know the size of the split state, so we don't know what that's going to happen, but if a producer is outside of this more restrictive area, I don't think they're going to want to bring their animals into the more restrictive area because then they're going to be subject to the restrictive testing requirements. So I don't think anybody would do that. And, this split state status appears like it's, going to happen, and people will have to make accommodations. You did mention me working in the area, and committee, I want to say that we have some pretty compressed committee timelines this year. This is a pretty big, complex, controversial issue that I'm working on, and I'm not done with it yet. But we've got committee deadlines, and so we're moving forward with what we have today. Both of these bills, or this bill is going to go off to finance. It's going to come back to the committee when we're sitting as a finance committee, so you will have another shot at all of this. Hopefully, you know, we'll have it all firmed up. I think we're getting pretty close now. You know, Senator Stumpf and I have been holding meetings up in that area, and it's hard work for the cattle producers and everybody involved to try to figure out what we're going to do here. But this split state status appears to me something that has to happen.
Any other questions? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chair, for right now, I would just like to lay 3725 aside and move on to 3728, if I could, please. Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment, but I think I'll wait to offer that this time, and let me start going through 3728. And members, as we've been discussing, we have a pretty serious problem in animal agriculture in Minnesota, this bovine TB. And, you know, I'm not here to say that this is the perfect answer to our problem, because I don't know that anybody does know exactly the best way to eliminate or eradicate this disease. We do know that we need to reduce the interface between deer and cattle. That means a number of things. That means reducing the number of deer. We're working with the DNR to get a relaxation of their permit process for people to shoot deer and finding ways to dispose of these deer easier. They are working on issuing permits to shoot elk. There are elk that are in the area. So we are making progress on that front. Members, this is an initiative to try to reduce the interface between cattle and deer. Like I said, I don't know if it's perfect, but I do know one thing for certain. We don't want to do nothing, because there is an example out there of a state that didn't take this seriously enough. They have spent well in excess of $120 million, and they are farther behind now than they were when they first had their outbreak. And from what I've been seeing, if you go back to when Michigan first realized that they had a bovine TB problem, their map looks very similar to what our maps looks like now. And they didn't act aggressively enough. So I don't know if this is perfect, but I am making this is a proposal that I'd like to see if we could provide some funding for and get support to go forward with it. So what I'm proposing here, and with the Board of Animal Health help, is that we would do a buyout of the cattle in that 56 herd area. It's not a perfect circle, but it's a circle somewhere in the neighborhood of about 34 miles in diameter, something like that. There's 56 herds. There's around 2,500 or 2,700 animals in that area. We would propose that the cattle producers would get $500 for an adult animal in the first year. They would be allowed to take that animal, because they currently do not test positive for bovine TB to market, and they would get those proceeds. Then we would make a $50 payment to them every year that they were not allowed to put animals back on their farm. I don't know how well this is going to be, but I think that a fairly large number of the smaller producers would look favorably upon this, because there is quite a problem and headache with all the testing requirements. I also have a bill in the tax committee that would allow these producers to receive some property tax relief, because, you know, if they don't have any animals on their land and they've got payments, they're going to be struggling. And so I'm kind of at this point in the legislative session searching around for things that I can offer to make this program work. So we would offer this buyout plan, and to the page, I've got that stuff that you printed, copied off for me. Could you hand that out? Is that out now? Okay, everybody's got a copy of this. This is what the Board of Animal Health has put together, kind of a proposal. So you can see what the numbers are, what the cost would be, what the assumptions are that we're going under. but we do have a little problem. In this zone, there are, and I don't have the exact number, but there's at least three and probably more. There's a dairy herd in this zone, and these guys aren't going to want to do the buyout. We know going in, I was met with these guys this last weekend, and as Senator Scogin mentioned, I wasn't a very popular camper. But we worked through a number of the issues, and I think I found some solutions to allow those farmers to not have to be part of the buyout if they didn't want to. There will be some pretty restrictive requirements on them if they keep animals in this zone, and we will require them to somehow with the Board of Animal Health to certify that there's no deer-cattle interface going on. Now, there are ways to accomplish this, one of which is fencing. And if you read in your proposal here, we do have some recommendations to the committee that we would help these guys with some of the fencing costs on an 80-20 share. So we're you know, bringing this to the committee. We'd like to get this sent off to finance to see if we can find some money to accomplish this. In the intervening time, we're certainly going to be having continued discussions on ways to improve or to make this work better. Maybe there's some alternatives to what we're proposing. But, you know, as we just, I think we have to do something. I think I'll move at this time to talk about the A1 amendment so we could get this included in the bill, and then we'll go to questions or perhaps to Dr. Hartman. Mr. Chair, could I move the A1 amendment? Members, what the A1 amendment is in the language of the bill, it requires the herd to be euthanized. As I said, we're not requiring that to happen. We are at requiring that they remove the herd from the farm and keep it off the farm until, in this language, the area, and I'd like to ask Mr. Knopf if perhaps we shouldn't use the word state there instead of area, achieves tuberculosis-free status. That would allow them to market those animals because, as I said, they are not positive bovine TB yet. They have no positive tests, and there would be quite a bit of value there for the rancher. And then in Section 3, one of the questions that kept coming up at the meeting that I had last week with the group in Grigla was, okay, so we're going to do this buyout, Senator Scoy, and we're going to fence our winter feeding areas, and we're going to do all this for you, and then, you know, we're going to fence our feed stock so that there's no deer in there, and then we're going to get to the summertime, and we're going to let our animals out on pasture. And how do we know that they aren't going to interface with the deer when they're in pasture and contact bovine TB? And Dr. Hartman, you maybe can help me here with this, but what I'm proposing in Section 3 is that we go to the North Central Research Station at Grand Rapids or maybe the Board of Animal Health or somewhere. I guess my original reaction was to the researchers at the University of Minnesota and study this lifestyle of the life cycle of the bovine tuberculosis in the pasture so that, you know, when we get going down this road, we know that a deer that will eat on that piece of grass and leave a little saliva, and then the cattle come along and eat the same piece of grass, doesn't get infected. Now, I know that ingesting, it takes more than inhaling and all of that, but I really think it's a piece of research that we need. It would bring a lot of help to these guys that are going through this herd buyout. So I think with that, do you have anything to add, Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scully, just to clarify, the biggest concern with this bacteria being transmitted in the feed or in the hay is during the winter. In the summer, when the cattle are on pasture, the sense is that the deer are not as likely to be mixing with them. And the conditions, the sun, the dryness, and that make it less likely that the bacteria would survive. So the key time is in the winter feeding areas and in the storage of the feed.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I mean, maybe we aren't going to need this amount of money. I'd like to leave a little language in there on the research for now. If it turns out we don't need it, we can take it out in the Finance Committee or when we come back here again. I could have left a blank appropriation. I just kind of picked a number because, as I said, this is not a finished product yet. But if the committee would adopt the A1 amendment, and then I'd like Dr.
Senator, Senator Scoy, before I go further. Senator Scogan, you had your hand.
Let's take care of the amendment, Mr. Chair, and then we can question away.
Mr. Chairman, just one thing on the amendment. Senator Scoy I don't know if we even spoke on this, but the term indemnity may not apply based on your handout earlier because there are different types of payments. And I was thinking that you should maybe remove the word indemnity in both places that it occurs and insert the word payments.
What line are you on?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you look on the amendment, here's a suggestion to make some changes on the amendment itself, on the A1 amendment. It'd be on line 1.2, before the euthanize, insert indemnity to euthanize the herd. So just indemnity to, so it would read indemnity to euthanize the herd. And then before remove, on that same line, insert payments to. And then also on line 1.4, after the word delete there, insert indemnity in quotes, and then insert payments, and then add and delete. That's kind of technical, but just to it would remove the word indemnity in both places that it occurs in the bill, and insert the word payments to make sure that the board could work out whatever payment structure it wants to work out with these producers.
Mr. Chair, is it okay if I incorporate that in my amendment?
Members, I think you have to realize this is really a statewide bill, because I sure as heck don't want that coming down in my part of the country. So I think we have to try, if we can stop it and control it up there, that area is a lot cheaper for all of us that live in other parts. And there's going to be a real change. It's nice to get money to buy your herd out, but remember, your income stops. There's nothing more to sell. Mm-hmm. Just nothing more to sell. So they don't get rich on this. They just soon keep their cattle and keep raising calves. And I think this makes more sense, because I don't think you're ever going to kill all the deer in northern Minnesota if you're out there every day with them expert sharpshooters. I don't think you can do it. I think we have to look at something else, and maybe this is a little easier to handle.
Mr. Chair, I think we're going to make an effort to remove as many deer as we can, but the key here is to reduce the interface between the cattle and the deer, so we need to be working in both areas. And, none of these people or ranchers are really very interested in this. You know, they've spent years building up the genetics of their herd. I mean, there's production loss when you sell off genetics that you've built up over a number of years, and nobody's very interested. This is tough stuff for those guys. Mr. Chair and Senator, or Mr. Knopf, Senator Vickerman, there is one more technical amendment on the A1 on line 9. Instead of lifestyle, it should be life cycle.
I think that sounds pretty good in here, the lifestyle.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that was something probably not reading my handwriting. And Mr. Chairman, also Senator Scoy, earlier you mentioned on line 1.3 whether the term area should be something other than that. I'm not sure. Don't you want to make sure that this is and actually, I suppose we could use the word zone, because we do describe zone earlier, that the zone is tuberculosis-free, not necessarily statewide. There could be additional. I mean, this is one zone we're talking about right now.
Mr. Chair, maybe Dr. Hartman can help us on that. Does it make a difference if it's area or zone or state? Because we're going to ask you guys to certify this. So what would you prefer?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoey, I think it would be best if it was the modified accredited area. because that's what that part of the state is going to become, and we'd want that part of the state to be free of the disease before we had them bring cattle back on it.
Okay, any other discussion? Senator Lurie.
I got on the bill itself on line 1.22, it references just fences, and I think it needs to talk about deer-proof fences or something in order to meet our needs. I don't know if that's the...
We should read that. Mr. Knaff.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I assume that says that you want to put the modified accredited in before area.
Yes, Mr. Knopf, I would like to incorporate modified accredited area into the A1 amendment.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, does everybody understand what the amendments are, or did you need to have them read?
Yes, Mr. Knopf, because I'm getting confused here.
There are a number of things going on here, so maybe, Mr. Chairman, the best way to do would be to read it as it will be amended into the bill, at least the appropriate pieces of it. So it would read on page 1, line 18, delete indemnity to euthanize the herd and insert payments to remove the herd from the farm and keep off the farm until the modified accredited area achieves tuberculosis-free status. And then on it would be page 2, line 2, delete indemnity and insert payments and delete euthanize and insert remove. And then on line 1.9, we're just going to delete lifestyle and insert life cycle on that line.
Everybody understand it? Senator Scoyer, do you want to incorporate?
Yes, I incorporated all those changes, and if we could adopt that amendment I would move the A1 amendment into Senate File 3728.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wonder if we shouldn't go to questions on Senate File 3728.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scogin, talk about deer interface a little bit. I know that you've got some producers who don't want the buyout, and I guess I need to know if we need to be more restrictive with the fencing language or if they told you how they plan to not have the deer interface with their cattle. Do they have a plan?
Well, Mr. Chair, and maybe Dr. Hartman can help me with what we're going to be able to do here. But one of the herdsmen that has been depopulated has a... there was three of the ranchers at my meeting on Saturday that have been depopulated. One of them is in an area where there isn't woods and there isn't deer, and it just isn't a problem. And when they came there to fence the feedstocks, he asked the guy from, I assume, the Board of Animal Health to go and find where the deer are so we would know where to fence, and they just couldn't find any sign. In the winter, it's pretty easy to assess that because of snow on the ground and you can see the deer tracks. And what my thought is if we go through this, and we do have Board of Animal Health personnel, two of them, I believe, that are up in that area, that they would be able to go and do a risk assessment of these farms. If there's risk, they would have to do something like fencing. That if there's no risk, then they wouldn't have to do that. We'd want to keep monitoring on that and see what that does. Now, Senator Lurie asked about the fencing. The discussion that I'm having with the ranchers up there is we would move beyond the current fencing that is currently there and probably do like a cyclone fence, a real fence with good steel posts and cyclone, and we know that we would not have interface at that point. One of the ranchers there thought that he could, and he said, well, I do have deer and I would have to fence, and he thought he would probably have a couple, two or maybe three feeding areas that would be approximately 20 acres in size. It's $16,000-$20,000 a site plus his feedstocks. You know, so we're talking maybe $80,000 for that rancher. The farm would pick up, or the state would pick up about 80% of that cost. He'd be responsible for 20%. This is a rancher that has gone through the buyout I can't remember exactly how many animals he had, about 1,000 animals depopulated, and he was able to buy 325 back out of the money he got from that 1,000 animals. So this is not a money-making operation for these guys. Mm-hmm. They are giving up a lot, and so we're trying to work with them the best we can to accomplish the goals, which is reduced interface.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, when did he have 1,000 head bought out?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, the gentleman he's talking about was the first infected herd that we found. He had 1,000 animals total. That included the bulls, the cows, and the calves. So he had about somewhere just under 600 cows that were depopulated, and that was done fall of 2005.
So he's gone through the time period, and then now he's putting cattle back on his property.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, let me talk just a little bit about why he put cattle back on his property. Because of the way we do capital gains, he had to put animals back on his land within 2 years, or he would have had a huge income tax problem. We're trying to figure out if there's some way that we can work through that. We don't know if we can or not. If we cannot, that very likely means that 2 years is about the extent that we're going to accomplish with this buyout, because, you know, they receive all this income, and the federal government controls that tax code, and they want their taxes off of it if they don't reinvest it. So we're going to see if there's something we can do there. We're certainly in contact with Senator or Congressman Peterson's office to see what we can do. But right now, that's why there's animals back there. It was a tax issue.
Sure.
Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scoy and Dr. Hartman, I'm just starting to hear now some of the time periods we're talking about when we're saying 2 years and they're going back on. So. How long is this disease cycle that if we do the depopulation and let the pastures sit there before it's going to be safe to put cows back on the pasture, but then we actually never really get rid of the potential problem because it still exists in the wild herd. Is that correct? So these fences that are going in have to be permanent fences as opposed to just separating the herds, the deer herd and the cattle for a while until it calms down, because there's always a potential that it's going to exist in the wild population, right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, that's why the language in this bill talks about that they couldn't put cattle back on these premises until that area is free of the disease. And what we would hope is at the same time we're free of the disease in cattle, we are in deer as well. Right now we've depopulated all the cattle herds that we know are infected, but we're not sure we've gotten all the infected deer. So that would be the issue. Once you've removed all of the infected deer and all of the infected cattle, the bacteria wouldn't survive through a summer and through the cleaning and disinfecting of those facilities. So we'd be safe then.
So then, Mr. Chair and Dr. Hartman, then these fences don't necessarily need to be permanent structures, then, but they need to be pretty sturdy, it seems, for maybe a couple of years. I'm just wondering about what people are going to be looking at in terms of barriers.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, the reason that we kind of went to the discussion that I had last weekend with these ranchers is because some of the mesh wire fences that were put up around the hay, the feedstocks, weren't surviving very well in the heavy snows. So we were kind of looking at a different route. And, you know, I don't sit here today and say I know what the fences are going to look like, but I know that if we're going to minimize the interface, they're going to have to be pretty good. And so deer can get around a lot of stuff and jump over pretty high fences, so they're going to have to be pretty good. And we're going to want them to last at least 2 years. This income tax issue is a problem that I'm going to have to deal with, and I'll try to have that resolved before I come back to the Finance Committee with this bill.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Skoy, did the herd owners, the cattlemen up there, do they have insurance against bovine tuberculosis? Is that something that is insurable, and do they carry insurance for that?
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, not that I know of. You know, just by coincidence, there is a producer from the region in the audience with me today. He didn't come down here because of this bill. He was here wondering how his legislators were doing on this issue. He is from the region. If you want to hear from him, I don't know if you want to say anything or not, but here's somebody who lives what we're talking about every day. And so, but no, I don't think there is any insurance, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, typically a livestock producer isn't insuring his animals for disease, typically. They have catastrophic stuff, fire and wind, and if a barn should fall down, but typically disease is kept out of the herd. I mean, you do the things you need to do to keep it out, and you assume it's getting done.
And Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Skoy and Senator Scogan. Do you know, is it possible to insure your herd against something like this or other disease? I'm ignorant. I'm trying to find out.
I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, I am not an animal producer, so I don't know what the opportunity for insurance is there. But I am a crop producer, and I can talk pretty knowledgeable about crop insurance. So I will just give you a little primer on ag insurance. When a farmer plants a crop and puts crop insurance on it, in order for him to collect the first dollar, he generally has to have, now there are differing levels, but generally the most popular is you have to have $35 of loss before you collect the first dollar. Now, I'm here to tell you that the margin in agriculture is not 35%. So if you are collecting on your insurance policy, you're in deep doo-doo. Because crop insurance, while you hear about crop insurance as some great thing that farmers get, if a farmer is collecting on crop insurance, he's in trouble financially because the margins are not that high. And they're really, really just kind of a minimal safety net to kind of hopefully get you through to the next year.
Well, Senator Hahn, if you carry crop insurance, that just makes the banker happy. You don't do nothing for you if you're sitting on it. Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm not an expert on health insurance on livestock, but I know a lot of these farm policies do cover lightning strike as just kind of a selling point. And I know there's dog and cat policies, and I suppose on horses there's policies you can get to ensure their health. But I would say the average livestock producer out there is not tuned into any kind of life or health insurance for, say, a cattle herd, and unless it's some special show cattle. But I think what I'd like to, Senator Skoy, I'd like to hear from your producer up north there if he wants to come down and tell us how things are.
Senators, I'm Gail Steinhauer. I farm with my brother of Thiefur Falls, Minnesota. Speaking in front of a group like this is not my cup of tea. I could think of a lot of things that I'd be doing on my cow herd. I'd much prefer to do this. I think a bunch of these issues are important, the buyouts and what else is. But it don't pencil. You're talking, you're giving him $500 for the cow, and he might get $500-$600 for salvage value. That's $1,100. That's close to what a cow is worth. But the $50 a year after that, I sell my cattle at 600-700 pounds, and get $600-700 for them. So you're talking, I'm getting 10 cents on the dollar for income the next year. I don't think any of us can afford to take that kind of loss in your checkbook as compared to mine. Taxes is a major thing here. The federales come after us after this. We got to invest. What do we do with this land? That we got payments on this land. We got things to do with it. And that's what we bought it for. And that just ain't going to cover it. You know, it may work out to buy out for the guys that are 65, 70 years old or more. Some of these cattle farmers are 80 years old, but they still don't want to sell because this is their lifestyle. And you're telling them to pull the pin, and they'll roll over and die. Feedlots are they're this feeding fencing for just a few acres, you know, to keep the cattle in. I think opens up another can of worms that you guys will have to address, and that's feedlots. You're congregating the cattle into a small little zone. And then, okay, then we have all the other EPA and the DNR and everybody else after our butts again. And we have enough expenses on this. The 80-20 split ain't going to cut that. That's another 20% off of us. You're talking $20,000, you know, 20%. That's big money. We don't make that kind of money. The key to this is eradicating the problem, the disease of TB, in my opinion, lays with one answer, and one answer alone. It probably will not be popular in the cities down here, and that is the use of helicopters to eradicate the deer and the elk if they so have the disease. There's only one way you can physically get over this territory and control it, and that is from the air. The sharpshooters will get 20-30%. Snaring them probably get another 20-30%. But we have to get this population down. Our goal should be eradicate the deer in that zone. But realistically, we get it down to 5-10%, and then we should continue after that. Last year, they moved they killed, using the DNR's numbers, they had 600 of them, or 1,100, I should say. They got it with hunting season and the sharpshooters, they got it down about 600. They had the survey here in January, it's up to 850 again. They keep moving in. We've got to do this in a quick, steady process. They've opened up the season now again. First off, us farmers, we're calving now. This will be our busiest time. We don't have time. Deer come in at a different time of the day all the time, especially if they've been shot at once. But the only way you do this is a safe system, and that's from the air, because you know what your target is. You can see it. You can cross this country. I would anticipate, and I don't think it's a far exaggeration, you know, they say there's 800 deer or 900 deer. You probably could do that in 2 weeks' time if you had a couple helicopters and some sharpshooters. I know it probably will not be popular with the friends of the animals, but this is a disease that's threatening our human race. And I think that should, if you're going to sell this thing and get this thing done, and it's going to cost money for the helicopters, but we have to. It'd be a lot cheaper than this fencing or the buyouts or anything else. Let's just nip this in the bud. And ideally, we got a 2 weeks' time, or you got to wait till next fall, and it should happen in the first snowfall. If you have any other questions, feel free to ask me.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. And Senator Skoy, just a question, and I don't know the technical localities involved with doing what is being suggested, but I certainly would support that. I'm from the cities and I like animals, but down here in the cities we have a problem with deer too, and we do have herd management practices, and it doesn't threaten our livelihood, it just threatens our roses. But I think, and I don't know what that would cost, but I'd certainly be open to entertaining that. My question though is, if you did that, if you did get the deer and elk population down to whatever the number is, does that take care of the problem? Is this something that if you did that you would then permanently eradicate the tuberculosis threat, or is it something that's likely to recur? I guess I'm just not sure what the vector is.
I believe that it would, if you got the deer and kept after them, and if the elk are infected, they have not properly tested the elk for various, the DNR does not want to shoot any bull elk, or they've been very reluctant in the past. just in their breeding, the way they breed. One else, the bull elk are the ones the most apt to get it. The bull elk are also the ones the most to travel because they get kicked out of their herd. I think you can control this disease and eliminate this disease if you do that, and we probably have to eliminate the cattle farmers that have the problem.
Senator Deal, you had a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, let me respond before we go on to the next question, if I could, please. I just have to say that I think there's some merit to trying to eliminate the deer as much as you can. I think it's physically very, very difficult to do, and we have a legal problem that a number of these deer are on private land, and we don't have the authority to go on that. So there are some problems with eliminating all the deer. You know, we're trying to work through with the department. And with regard to the elk, they are issuing permits to shoot elk now, and they have killed one bull elk, and they're working on that also. So with that.
Well, Senator Hill, last question.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm wondering if Mr. Knopf can draw up an amendment to put on Senator Scoey's bill that would authorize the DNR and others, other appropriate officials, to use helicopters and aircraft to thin out the deer herd up there. Is that possible? Are we dealing with a federal law or a state law?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoey.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, I just had discussions with Senator Chaudhry today about some provisions that are going to be worked on in the Environment Committee. We're talking about expanding the no feeding of deer range, maybe going statewide with it. We're talking about increasing the penalties for people that violate this ban because the monetary penalty doesn't have much effect on some of these individuals. We're thinking maybe we'll take away their right to hunt deer for a couple years if they don't go along with the deer feeding ban. And we're in the process of having some discussions because these sharpshooters, while they're called sharpshooters, they're really USDA trappers. And we're talking about giving the U.S. to see if there's some way to give the USDA the authority to go on private land and kill deer. I don't know if we can do that or not.
Senator Scoey and Senator Dill, if this bill moves, it goes to finance, it'll come right back here, and then you can work some of it, because it's 5 o'clock, and Senator Marty, I promised him, I've got other meetings that's going on through there, so I think we better, we've come a long way. And do you want to say a few words? Sure.
Just one more couple comments. I guess I'm not, as a producer, I have deer. I'm just on the edge of where they're going to draw the line. The maps, it could be a half mile one way or the other. And so they've already had the feeding ban. And now after they put the feeding ban in effect, I have more problem with deer coming because I got my stuff and they come in like you invited your relatives in.
Great.
I had another thought here. I guess I can't remember what it was, but sorry. Thank you.
Sir, this bill, as I said before, will go to finance. It'll come back here, and then we can, if you want to do some more fine-tuning or something, Senator Scoey.
Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is I've checked for a House author on 3725, and I didn't see one. I do know I have a good House author on 3728. So I'd like to move Senate File 3725 as an amendment to 3728.
Okay. Does everybody understand? Senator Council.
Mr. Chairman, you need to move that as amended. You did move an amendment to that bill, so
I'd move 3725 as amended be incorporated. So
everybody,
I'm not carrying
understand.
Two pieces of bill along. Let's just do one.
Scoey's motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopt. Thank you, Senator Scoey.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, then I'd need to 3728 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee as amended.
On Senator Scoey's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Senator
members.
Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I've sent file 2055, and I would like to have distributed the A3 amendment. This can't be an author's amendment because the bill's already been through one committee, but this is an amendment that's designed to address some of the concerns that were raised in that committee.
Turn her up.
I'll move that amendment that comes around.
And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is an issue of registration of pesticides, and what I would like to do and what the amendment would do would be to make it clear that what the original intent was that the Ag Department would continue to deal with environmental and ag-related issues, but that the Health Department, Health Commissioner, would be involved in registration related to health-related concerns. And I want to speak to the bill briefly, and I know there are others who wanted to comment on it briefly as well. But in terms of looking at the health risks of pesticides, we know, I mean, the whole purpose of pesticides is to destroy pests, whatever kind. And we know that they have other impacts on other lives, including human life. And I think farmers have become very much in recent years more alert to the concerns about it. They're much more cautious about use of it. I think it's often more in my part of the state where homeowners are using whether in-house pesticides or lawn care pesticides where they think, you know, we got dandelions, we want to really kill them all, so we'll use, they don't follow the label instructions, they use more than they're supposed to. But I think there is a growing awareness of risks related to this. Other jurisdictions, other countries, other states have begun putting restrictions on certain pesticides. Atrazine, which has been an issue discussed here in the last several years, some Wisconsin is, I believe, is may have it totally prohibited from a good number of acres of farmland. European Union has banned it entirely. But the point, the reason for the bill is that I have concern that both federal government and state often waits too long after we've known of risk levels that may be higher than we should be accepting before they act on it. One example I'll give on that is several years ago I had a bill related to the banning of copper chromated arsenate, the CCA, the wood treatment that when you buy deck wood and so on, it's green treated wood. I remember when I first brought the bill in, we had the wood products industry flew in some people from Georgia and Washington, D.C. to tell me how safe it was, how no risks, and I mean, I read the labels that they have on the wood at Home Depot and so on, and they all basically, it was more a promotion of how safe it was rather than what the risks were.
Senator Marty, it's been a long day for me, and I don't think you made the motion, but we didn't adopt the amendment. I think we ought to adopt that to get the bill in the order that you would like to have it. So Senator Robes moves the adoption of the A3 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Now your bill should be in order, Senator.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so with the example of the copper, the green-treated wood, again, they flew in lobbyists from all over the country to talk, myself and the House author, about how this is perfectly safe, and no risk, no problem. And about 2 years later, the EPA announces an agreement with the industry, no more production of CCA-treated wood because the risk was too great. And the frustration is that, and my concern is, our Ag Department does a good job at looking at the concerns from the agriculture-related risks. They are working at, I'm not sure as aggressively as I'd like, the environmental risks, but they're not the experts, they're not the people who deal with the health. So this was an attempt to try and engage the Health Commissioner and the Ag Commissioner. They're in the same building now, they share the same lab, and try and get them working together. And again, with the bill as amended, it would make it clear the Ag Department retains its registration authority, but the Health Commissioner would also have the authority to deal with health-related risks. And with that, that's all I wanted to say about the bill. I believe Farmers Union may have some comments on it. I believe the Department does. And I just appreciate if they could.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question on the amendment that we just adopted. I'm trying to understand it. And maybe Councilor Senator Marty, the line 1.7 of the amendment says, page 2, line 7, delete the new language. Does that mean delete the entire line and replace it with the line in the amendment? Is that what we're saying?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Marty. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Peterson's here from Farmers Union and can comment on the bill. Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Peterson. Represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I did speak in favor the other day in Health Committee of moving this bill to the committee. I guess I would still have some concerns with it. I appreciate all the work Senator Marty's done on this bill. A couple of things. One thing that's changed a little bit in Farmers Union is this last year our members did support trying to get the Department of Health involved in looking at some of these registrations and how it might work. And so moving in that direction, I think, is good. And I hear from certain areas of the state, southeast area especially, where people are a little more concerned about some of the things going on. And so in talking to the department, too, I think the department is working on addressing some of those concerns and trying to get that message out to what they're doing in the process to those farmers. Senator Marty put in a piece in the amended it in the Health Committee to delay the implementation date too. My concern is if you take from the Department of Agriculture to the Department of Health, there might not be any changes in the process. Farmers are used to what they're going to buy, what they're going to plant, what they're going to kill the pests with, and they got to have some kind of certainty in that process. And so if it went to the Department of Health, I don't know, you know, what the time frame is or what the cost is that they could do that. And so to tell our farmers that next year, you know, they might not be able to plant this and use that, that was the concern with that. And so in looking at this process, if something was going to change, we wanted to kind of see how that lays out. And I still have concerns about that, but I think it's moving that direction. So maybe if there's a way that, you know, the Department of Health consults with the Department of Agriculture or something in the process going forward, I think would be helpful. But I did want to, you know, mention that I think it's important to know that some of our farmers are now, a lot of our farmers think it works just fine, but we are seeing some farmers say with some concerns about some of those issues of the Department of Health. And so I will leave it at that.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Peterson, you know, you talked about the timeliness of this if we are going to be sending this these applications through the Department of Health. You know that a lot of times we have these issues that arise in agriculture that require pretty rapid action. I think they're called Section 18 applications, et cetera. What would happen under that scenario if it had to go through the Department of Health and Department of Ag and everything when we're trying to respond fairly quick?
Mr. Chairman, that's why I'm not ready to support the bill today, because I don't think that process is laid out on how that might happen, you know, and so trying to give producers, you know, answer those questions. I don't think that bill, the bill right now, even as amended, lays that kind of, you know, answers those questions. But, and maybe, you know, that process is something that they can work on and it isn't, you know, a cumbersome process, and maybe it is, but I don't feel comfortable the bill states that. And,
Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
I'm Chair from the Ag Department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinn Cheney, and I'm the Policy Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. As you know, the Department of Agriculture is responsible for the regulation of pesticides. Of course, pesticides pose risks, but they also provide a lot of benefits to society. So they are very highly regulated, and we take those regulatory responsibilities very seriously. While there are merits to additional state review in the registration process, Senate File 2055 is, we believe, is overreaching, and it creates a highly duplicative process, which we don't feel is necessary. We believe that the bill would have us conducting hundreds and potentially even thousands of product reviews. Furthermore, the bill would drastically change the pesticide regulation policy, which is right now with from a risk-benefit analysis to a health-only policy with no consideration to the societal benefits for the use of pesticides. I do want to be clear that the MDA acknowledges the legitimacy of conducting additional state review of pesticides. In fact, we are currently in the process of conducting a special review of atrazine, and I do have Greg Bezicki here who can provide some more information on that process if anybody would like. The Department of Agriculture is opposed to the bill to send it to 2050, Senate File 2055 in its current form, but we've had very positive dialogue with Senator Marty, and we're very happy to be talking with him and would like to continue working with him in the next several months.
Senator Marty, do you have anybody else?
Mr. Chairman, no, and I wanted to indicate to you what Ms. Cheney said as well. We've had some good discussions, and the department is committed to, and again, I want the same thing with the health department, to be in discussions in the coming months. And with that, I told the department before this that I would be willing to withdraw the bill and continue discussion with them. And I appreciate your taking 10 minutes to talk about this. I know it's late in the day, but I plan to withdraw the bill now, and we'll work with the department, both departments, because I think it is a growing concern from people, and the concern Senator Skoy made about emergency use, those are all legitimate concerns. I realize this isn't ready to be enacted as is now, but I do think, and I don't think the department would move as aggressively on the health issues as I'd like, but I think that's where we can discuss things during the interim.
Senator Coring.
You know what? I think I'm just going to pass.
Thank you.
It's late in the day for me.
That's not necessary. You know what? Maybe I will take my time.
Senator Scogin, you got 15 minutes. That's the longest.
There you go. Well, you know what? And I just want to reiterate something that I said the other night again. Number one, I don't like this bill, and I'm glad glad the department says that not happy with the bill. But I would reiterate what I said, and this is just for the benefit of the members. I believe that we are the policy makers here, and this is nothing against you. I think you're great. But we're the policy makers, and I guess when departments come forward and say, well, we really don't like that bill, and then right away we as policy makers say, oh, well, I guess we're going to have to do something different. You know, we make the policy, they implement the policy. And I just want to reiterate that again so that we don't forget that, because, otherwise we're not steering the ship. The bureaucrats are steering the ship. And every time, Paul Coring comes up with a great idea and they don't want to do it, they come up with a $10 million fiscal note and they go, oh, my God, we can't do this. And then it's shot down, So that's my only thing. And I'm glad Senator Marty withdrew that because I was going to move to table it.
Senator Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, I want to reflect, too, a little bit on some of the bills we've heard earlier this week. And although they don't seem to get very far, I just want to encourage members to continue thinking that there are people on both sides of the issue that are really willing to work together and try to find something that's going to work. I heard Senator Marty talking about withdrawing some of the deadlines and implementing some of these strategies in ways that are going to work. No one is interested in pulling the rug out underneath anyone's feet. But frankly, there is going to be continued public interest and citizen interest in having some sort of reckoning with the fact that we do have health impacts in some of our, whether it's the mining industry or the agriculture industry or even the healthcare industry itself having healthcare impacts for people. So we just have to continue to be open and wrestle with this a little bit. I appreciate Senator Marty bringing the bill, and I know the department has been great working with me on my bills and Senator Marty as well, but we're just going to have to keep moving forward, trying to find a way that's going to work for both sides, because some of these issues just won't go away. We're going to have to find that middle ground.
Any further discussion? Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize to the committee. I just need to make one comment. I do think, and we've had a number of issues that deal with the science of pesticides and chemicals, and it is an important issue. We all recognize that. But But I have to be honest, I've been a little frustrated, too. I think some of the rhetoric that we see on this issue is so extreme that I really fear that the public gets concerned unnecessarily on occasions when they don't need to be. And so I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if the department or others can help us. But I think we need better, maybe some more objective information that is taken out of the political arena to some degree so that it isn't just being, one politician talking about another politician's opinion. But I think the science of this has to be better understood in part of the public. And until we get there, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to really determine how best to do this. So I appreciate Senator Marty. I know he's very interested and very sincere in what he would like to do. But I think we need to get some balance and some better information.
Senator Laurie.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief. I'd just like to say that I think that, too, we do need to be based largely on science. And I think that there are some health issues involved in the use of ag pesticides and chemicals, and I think that we have very good scientists and experts in the Department of Health that we really should be reaching out to and having them as part of the mix. And so I do support the broader goal of bringing in all of the experts that we have that I trust a great deal to help guide us in our job to steer the ship. And so I hope that we can work on this.
We just have to do the ag part of this. Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'm not going to give you a big fancy pesticide speech again, but I'm just going to say simply that if it weren't for pesticides, chances are we'd all be about 4 inches shorter, 30 pounds lighter, and half of us would be dead.
Which half? Any further discussion? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
And we'll get to that point sometime. We have one more piece of legislation. That's Senator Oaks.
Sorry, what?
Shouldn't take over 5 minutes. Quinn Cheney, stay right here.
Get another bill. Which bill do we have?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's Senate File 3633, and all we're going to be looking at is the ag part of the bill. The Veterans has already done that, I believe I'm right. So this will be just the ag part. So
members of the committee, again, Quinn Cheney with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Madam Chair. I'll be really quick. Our budget reductions that the governor's office proposed are here in the bill. I think you all have copies. For the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the reduction is a $102,000 reduction for fiscal year 2009. That would come from our administrative services, which would include the commissioner's office, the IT, human resources, and finance and budget divisions. For the Board of Animal Health, I know you've already discussed this extensively. For the Board of Animal Health, it would be an increase of $472,000 in fiscal year 08, as well as a $2.252 million increase for fiscal year 09 and beyond. That would be for the additional control and eradication efforts that we want to take on to get rid of bovine tuberculosis. That's it.
I'm going to ask staff, do I need to move the bill, or is it just...
No, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, we're just going to leave the bill here. It's the omnibus budget bill, and we'll be working on that in the coming weeks.
Right. Okay. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Okay. If there's nothing else from the committee, we're adjourned. Thank you. just really